Welcome to Ebiquit Quill Sisters, where Mi'kmaq porcupine quill workers share the stories behind their art. In this episode, you'll hear about the materials we use to edge our quill work, how trees talk to each other, and whether Cheryl will ever find something in the woods Kay will eat. Side note, probably not.
Hey, Kay.
Hey, how are you?
Not too bad. I'm Cheryl Simon from Dartmouth, Nova Scotia.
This is Kay Sark from Lennox Island PEI.
Are you ready to talk about quill work again?
Always.
So this week, we're going to be talking about how we edge our quill work.
With mine, I don't normally edge it with anything but sweetgrass.
That's what you do? So what we're talking about when we say edging, it's when we get finished the design in the center of the bark, and then you've got that raw edge of bark. And so edging is just what material we sew onto it to kind of cover that raw edge.
I think there was once I used quills to do it, but I prefer sweetgrass. Even when I get low on sweetgrass, I'm like, oh my God, I need to find some. I don't bother like thinking, hey, let's be a creative native and use some other stuff that you have.
Well, and I think that's one thing about materials is that when you're really looking at what we use, the sweetgrass is the easiest to find, right? We can either harvest it ourselves or you can buy it in stores. Like people will sell braids of sweetgrass year round. Yeah. So it's definitely one of those things that when you run out and it's the dead of winter, you're okay.
I don't like buying them in braids though, because they're all like squiggly.
I know. They get bent, right?
Yeah. Someone who I did buy some from that was in a braid, he said he just like brushed it out and put water in it and then hung it up and went back to being straight, I guess. Mm. When I got it, it was straight.
What I find too is that my mother was the one that taught me how to harvest sweetgrass, right? Because she and my gram would always go down to my auntie's. We have a family patch not too far from Scotchford that we all go to. And when you do it, you have to take the heart out of the sweetgrass, right? So sweetgrass, given by the name of it, is just a grass. It grows along close to where the shore is. And I like the sweetgrass from PEI. Like I know that I'm from here and I'm a bit biased, but I really like it because all of our rivers are salty. So when you get the sweetgrass, it's a really, really intense, it's got a really strong smell to it. And I like that. And the grass grows really long. Whereas I've had sweetgrass sometimes from, you know, the prairies and other ecosystems where it tends to be a little bit shorter. So that's one of the reasons why there's a couple of reasons, but the primary reason I really love PEI sweetgrass.
And the smell stays forever. Like I have pieces from like 2 years ago. And they smell so good still.
It does smell good, but I find that if you don't store it properly, the green will fade with it. It'll just turn brown like a normal grass. And my mom, who taught me how to harvest it, she said that you have to take the heart out of the sweetgrass. So even when you're looking at the different Mi'kmaq words around it, there's a word for the actual heart of it. So it's kind of like the center part. It grows up like inside, the leaves grow up around it. And if you take that out, you can use that and the leaves. But if you don't do it, that's what makes it go brown.
Yeah.
If you buy it, not everybody has done that because it takes a long time to do. Like you literally have to go through every piece of sweetgrass and clean it up, take the center of the heart out of it, and then bundle it up. I find sometimes if you buy it in the stores, people haven't done that. They're just kind of trying to make some money off it. And so you do run the risk of not getting good quality.
Yeah, I'm not the best sweetgrass picker. I don't know. I haven't done it too many times. I prefer to like support other people who are out there doing it. There's a couple of people on Lennox who go down there to pick. They do it properly.
Just think about when you said doing it properly. There was tools at the museums. You could see they're basically like a sweetgrass comb. They're made out of wood and the teeth of the comb are quite wide apart. And you literally would comb the sweetgrass to get it all nice and smooth. So Kay, before you started quill work, like how familiar were you with sweetgrass?
Not. Like I was not familiar at all with it.
But had you seen it around at all? Or at all?
Like I've seen it around. I've seen braids here and there. I've seen people burning it to smudge and stuff, but that's about it. Like I didn't know. I knew you can get it down at the bridge. I didn't know how to get it. I didn't know what other uses there were for it other than seeing it burning in a smudge bowl, in a braid, in a car.
I remember when I was little, people used to have, they almost look like little brooms almost made out of sweetgrass that were kind of folded and sewn together to make this little decoration. And people used to hang it on their walls in their houses. And I remember my mom and my gram talking about how it was a way to have medicines in your house to protect yourself and your family and your space that the Indian agent or other people wouldn't know were indigenous medicine. Like it just kind of looked like a little wall decoration. And I always thought that was kind of interesting that people were doing that as a way of kind of getting it in there without getting in trouble for it.
You know, now that you you mentioned that little broom. I think I've seen that before.
Yeah, you see them. They're sold a lot, right? And that's what I was told about them. We'll have to put a picture up when those little brooms kind of look like.
That's pretty cool. I know, I haven't thought about that in years.
Well, it's because I think you don't have to see them anymore. Like, people don't make them as much, right? Like, you can just go down and people have braids of sweetgrass that you can get, you know, for smudging and stuff. And there's also a lot of other products you can get, like sweetgrass oil that people are using, liquid smudge, or, you know,
candles,
soap.
Candles.
I like the soap. It's really quite nice as well.
One of my coworkers, she has this air freshener for her car. It's like this little feather or something, but the smell is sweetgrass and it smells amazing.
I like having sweetgrass in my car because when the sun heats up your car in the winter, especially in the summertime, you can smell the sweetgrass in your car. And it always makes me feel nice when I feel it.
A friend out in BC, she's from here. So when she was down 2 years ago, I gave her a nice size braid for her car. That way she can have a piece of home. And she loved it.
That's just nice.
She's like, now I could tell all my friends when we're driving around. I mean, she didn't sound like that, but
she's probably out in BC saying, Kate, that's not how I sound at all.
Right? She's going to call me and be like, when I'm driving around.
So then the first time you ever picked it, was that when I took you out when you were in the apprenticeship program?
Yep. That was the first time I ever picked it.
It was kind of funny when we were deciding where to go to pick it, because we're in Lenox Island. And I mean, there's sweetgrass in Lenox, but I've never harvested there, right? Because it's not my community. And I, you know, like, my extended family lives there and stuff like that. But I basically took all of you guys out to my family's patch, what, almost 2 hours away, to go harvest where my family's patch is, where I'm comfortable, where I know the area, all this type of stuff. And rather than going in someplace closer to Lenox, which would have been a lot more convenient, but it wasn't the area that I knew, and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't my patch.
I've been down to the one here a couple times since then. I had one friend who came with me just recently, the past few years, has been trying to get to her Mi'kmaq roots. And she was like, can I go sweetgrass picking with you? And I'm like, yeah, you can. Like, of course. So her and her daughter came. So it was really nice. Like, I got some really nice pictures of them bonding over sweetgrass.
Yeah, it's a fun thing to do when you've got a group of people. And when it comes to the family patches, it's funny how much people still maintain them. You know, like, I have an aunt out in Alberta, uncle's living in New Brunswick, and they still every year come home to pick on the family patch outside Scotchmort Reserve, right? As they think about that, flying from Alberta to come back to pick it, because again, like, that's our family patch. That's just where she was taught and everything. So I like that we still do that we have those patches. Although I was getting a bit concerned that people were getting too much was being harvested from our patch, because it's been really great lately, especially after the TRC commission, where people are wanting to learn more about Indigenous culture. Harvesting sweetgrass, especially where it's such a strong medicine, was a great way for people to kind of, you know, have that bonding experience like your friend did and get out and learn how to harvest. But at the same time, you don't want to overwhelm the resource, right? You're supposed to move around a lot when you harvest. That way you're not overpicking in one little area. So you kind of have to cover a distance. And that's great that people do that. But if everybody's doing that, you know, eventually it might be a little bit too much. So my mom and I have actually been talking about, when, especially with students, you know, when you have large groups of people, if they want to come out to learn about sweetgrass, that we don't just do it by picking. Like, well, let's teach them how to fertilize it, right? Like, let's go out and show them how to care for the patch and where it is and what it looks like. That way we're not going to basically be doing damage.
So when she does take people out to harvest and stuff, do they pick and then only pick like a little bit so they know what they're getting, or?
They were, yes. Because I mean, like, everybody wants to have it, but then it was also kind of the question, well, make sure that you use it, right? Like, you don't want to go out and pick sweetgrass for the sake of picking it and then not do anything with it or have it go to waste. It's kind of fun because you have to pull it up by the roots, right? I find that these days I like doing it when I'm wearing my sunglasses, because the polarized lenses actually makes the sweetgrass shimmer a little bit in the light. So when you're down by the water's edge, there's a lot of different grasses that are there. But if you're wearing your sunglasses, you can really pick out which ones are sweetgrass and which ones aren't.
Oh, pro tip happening.
I don't like doing it just with my plain glasses.
I think, was it you that told me that time? Like, look at the sun briefly and then look down, and then whatever shimmering is probably sweetgrass.
Yeah. It gets that kind of like iridescent almost look to it, right?
Yeah.
I don't know if iridescent is probably the wrong word for it, but everybody else about, go, Cheryl, that's not how you describe it at all. But yeah, so it was one of those things. And, you know, like, when you look at the development and stuff like that, or people, when they're looking at different land to add to the reserves and stuff like that, it's like, well, make sure that if we're doing anything along the water, that our sweetgrass patches is protected.
Where is there other ones on PEI other than your patch in Lenox? Is there more?
Well, didn't you and Pat find that one that was down along, like along the provincial road, like just kind of heading into Summerside? There was that area.
Oh, yes. I was scared that someone was going to come out of the house that was not too far from where I was and be like, you're not allowed to do this. So I called Cheryl and I'm like, hey, what's that treaty that says that we're allowed to pick sweetgrass and crap?
My response to Kay was, well, I've never heard of a treaty right to crap.
But the so here she is taking me all literal. Taking me all literal over there when I was just like in that moment, like, oh my God, I'm going to get in trouble.
You didn't though, which was good.
No, I just wanted to know what I like could say to them. I just wanted to be like, you know what, according to the treaty of whatever year that is, I'm allowed to do this.
Well, especially since there's been so many of them, right, from 1725 all the way up to 1794 and beyond kind of thing. We have a lot of treaties in Mi'kmaq territory.
Yeah. And again, I'm just not familiar with the numbers. I can't remember stuff like that. I just know that I'm allowed to do it or something. And
well, and it's kind of funny.
Cheryl knows all about that. So I just message her and be like, what am I allowed to do?
Yeah, so the treaties protect our way of life. And like I said, probably theoretically the right to crap, but I would love to see that in court.
Yeah, insert eye roll when I read that message. Oh, that was so funny.
Yeah, it was. So, but yeah, so I guess at the end of the day, what we're supposed to say about sweetgrass harvesting is that we do go, like we have family patches. It's fun to go out with a group of people, except for the fact that I don't harvest in skirts. And I know that some people do just because I just don't like the bugs going up skirt, to be frank about it. And I know some people wear pants underneath their skirts, you know, when they're harvesting that way, but that was always but something.
Bugs will still get up there.
Yeah. The patch too by Scotchford has a bit of a hybrid grass. I know last week we were talking about the hybrid birch trees with the poplars, and there is another grass that it's kind of like, you know, with the pollen and spreads, we've got a little bit of a hybrid going on there, but it's always interesting to kind of pick it out because you really have to look at the full plant, right? What are the roots looking like? That look in the sun, does it smell? Because some of these hybrid plants, they've got a couple of the characteristics, but maybe not all of them.
I didn't know that.
So would you come help us fertilize Kay if we're putting like blood meal or something like that down to help fertilize the plant?
What is blood meal?
It's literally what you think. It's like when they, you can buy it for your gardens. It's got like, it's kind of like dehydrated blood that's got, that's a bit of a, like a powder almost. And you got to spread it very, very far with it. You don't want to put a lot of it in a concentrated area because you don't want to like attract animals and stuff like that. But that's one way of getting more of the nutrients in, and the grasses really respond to it and grow up nice and green.
Side note, I wish you guys could see my face. probably not. It's a powder.
Yeah, like you can buy it at garden stores.
So when you said like, oh, what you think, I'm like,
oh, you were thinking really blood.
I was thinking like a blood meal, like bloody meals something. No. That I okay, yeah, my mind went somewhere else. I never heard of that, but you know.
Yeah, you just got to make sure that you get lots of food in there for them too. It really grows like green. A friend of mine up in Cape Breton was doing that, and it's fantastic the difference that it makes with the patches, you know, to make sure. Because like I said, you do have to, when you pull it up by the root, that's what stimulates the growth. So it's not something that you want to cut, right? So you have to pull, kind of like when you pick rhubarb, you have to pull it up so that the rhizomes and stuff like that are able to produce more and the plant will continue to grow and send up new growth.
I never did that either.
So I think that's probably it. We're not going to talk too much about, like I know that we did the in-depth episode about birch, but we're not going to go in-depth with the sweet grass or the spruce root. We'll just kind of talk a little bit generally as these last couple of things that we use for edging. So should we move on to spruce root?
Yeah.
So I think maybe as a quiller, the spruce trees are probably my second favorite tree in the woods outside of the birch. And I was taught how to harvest again by Todd Labrador, the canoe maker down in Nova Scotia. But I've talked with other elders as well and knowledge keepers about harvesting spruce root. What we use is the black spruce, the root of it, and you pull it up out of the ground, you dig it up, peel off the bark, and then you split it down so that you can sew with it. And we talked in another episode about how you know, spruce root to sew together containers and wigwams and canoes and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think I was with you guys once when you were harvesting the spruce root. I thought it was pretty cool, but I just find it very difficult to work with myself.
Yeah, it does take quite a bit of practice to get used to it. Yeah. And you always have to kind of keep it really wet too, so it doesn't start to splinter a bit. But I actually really like harvesting on Lennox Island because it's really peaty. there. So the acid, right, you can really just lift up the layer of almost kind of moss, and then the roots are there. So it's not a lot of digging. In Nova Scotia, yeah, it definitely takes more effort. It gets challenging if you are in a rocky area, because the roots will grow up and around and over rocks and stuff like that. So they get really twisted and they're not nice and smooth. Whereas in the peat moss, they just don't have as much resistance. So they tend to grow a little bit straighter. So I really like it. But the acidity of the soil does change the roots though too. But when you're talking with elders about spruce roots, I've never seen anybody talk about the roots in the forest without intertwining their hands together when they're talking to you about how everything is interconnected under the ground. Because the root systems of trees are phenomenal. And I find that this is one area of knowledge where Western science is just now starting to catch up with the Mi'kmaq and Indigenous knowledge around trees. Because the root systems are not just about nutrients and water and sugar. It's also a form of communication between the trees. So I think that when you look under the ground, the trees are all interconnected. It doesn't matter what type of species they are. It doesn't matter if they're older or younger. Their roots are all woven together and they support each other. And it's actually literal too, because they'll actually share nutrients and sugars between the different types of trees.
There you go with your hands as you're talking about it. You started doing that with your hands.
I know. It's like, yeah, because like under the ground, they're all interwoven and they're supporting each other, right? Like it's just, there's so many lessons there about how to share resources and to communicate with each other for the good of the forest, as opposed to just being an individual. Because when you look in the woods or you see trees above ground, you just think, oh, like there's a maple tree, there's a spruce tree, whatever. But underground, there's not that type of disconnect between them. They're all literally connected with each other. The edge of the roots, like they have these kind of like hair-like fibers. There's a fungus that grows on them. And that is actually the fungus root system is how the trees will communicate with each other.
Oh, well, there you go. Blowing my mind again.
I know. Well, it was so funny because like I said, like Western science is just starting to catch up on this knowledge, right? So if you look at the mycelial network, and the mycorrhizae is the fungus that grows on the roots. And so it's really fascinating that the trees will like alert each other to predators that they're getting eaten. If one of the tree dies, the network can actually kick in and keep its system going. So, and they have like what are called mother trees in the woods, which will literally feed their saplings with enough sugars and nutrients that they need to keep them alive until they can get up high enough in the sun to make their own food.
Wow. That's amazing. I didn't know all this. So I'm like, oh my God.
Yeah.
In my mind, one time after another.
Because when you say that like trees talk to each other and communicate, I always worry that what people are picturing is, you remember Pocahontas, the Disney movie, when the old tree turned into the face of a woman.
Grandmother Willow.
Exactly. And it's like, no, Disney, that's not how trees communicate. And that's not what Indigenous people are saying the way that they communicate, you know?
Oh, that's hilarious.
I know. But you can just picture that. So people are talking about, right? Oh, trees talk to each other. So of course it has to be the way that humans talk to each other.
I was picturing like Avatar.
Oh yeah.
And they kind of that's how it. I think of it. That movie where they're like, it's all connected. And I mean,
well, that's true that they are all connected, right? But it's a really fascinating science. So it's really important when you're harvesting spruce root that you're not actually taking too much of the root from the tree, because one, you're going to interrupt that communication network and the vital sharing of nutrients. And you also don't want to damage the tree by, you know, cutting it off from its supply of food.
So then how do you know what's too much? Because like I've only done it once or twice, right? Like harvested
the spruce root. So basically, if the tree is in the center, picture it like a clock, you would only want to take root from 15 minutes of the clock. So like a little angle out, that's about it.
Okay.
So you wouldn't want to harvest all the way around the tree. You only want to do it like harvest within a quarter of the circle around a tree, of the circumference.
Okay, that makes sense.
But the tricky thing though is when you're following the roots, you're not entirely always sure which root belongs to which tree because they're so interconnected. Like I said, you just have to really be aware not to overharvest.
Yeah, take what you need.
Yeah. And I had fun actually harvesting with Todd Labrador when he was doing the canoe, because I was actually looking for smaller roots than he was, because he wanted the bigger ones for, you know, stitching together his canoe. Yeah. He and his son-in-law were digging up the ground and I kind of was going along, behind them and just taking up the smaller pieces. And it was fantastic because we didn't have to dig up more of the ground that was needed, and we all got our needs met, right? So in terms of the spruce root that we were after.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, it was. It was quite nice. When it comes to spruce trees, we could probably talk just as long about them as we could about the birch trees, right? But I know that I really enjoy eating the spruce tips off them. And both of my children will harvest those whenever we're out in the springtime and the spruce tips are out. It's got the new growth or slightly lighter green, and they just landed the branches. It's the new needles that are being put out by the tree. And when they're kind of clustered together in springtime, you just pick them off and you can put them in salads. You can make tea with them. You know, they've got nutrients for a medicine. You can grind them up and use them as a spice. Like, they're phenomenal.
Still not going to do it.
You've got a look on your face, Kay.
I know. I'm not going to do it.
but what about the tea though? Because the tea is a really nice light flavor. Like, it's really quite tasty if it was just like a regular tea.
No, I like my orange pea coat.
Fair enough. I was out with my friend one time and we had our children with us, and her oldest daughter was complaining that she was hungry, and we were out in the woods on this, you know, quite a long hike, and she didn't want the snacks. And so I was like, oh, if you're hungry, here. And I just picked all these spruce tips off. I said, these are edible. You can eat these if you're hungry. She popped a few in her mouth. She didn't say anything, but she never again complained that she was hungry when she was in the woods if I was with them.
Oh, you would.
Yeah.
You would.
So she's like, no, I'm fine. No, I'm good, Cheryl. I'm good. I've got enough. I'm like, okay.
She's probably like, Mom, can we not go for a walk with her?
Yeah. Just note to self, never, ever, ever again say that I'm hungry in the woods. So once we have the spruce root, like we've talked before about having to take the bark off and how my house sometimes smells like a swamp when I've got it soaking up in our bath. What I thought was really funny about was learning how to split it, because it didn't really come naturally to me. Like, it was something that I really had to practice, because you have to boil it if it's dry, like if the ground has been dry rather, and then you strip the bark off it and then you coil it up, and you can keep it like that until you're ready to use it. It's really nice and light and it just hardens up and it's really good to go. And then when you want to use it, you just soak it in the water and then you can start splitting it. So if you split it in half and then split it again in quarters, there's a core as well to the inside of the root. So then you have to take the core off. And so you're basically just kind of using the outer layers of the root.
Yeah, I have a hard time splitting that stuff. I've tried it a few times, and I've got, Cole actually gave me some. He's like, here, you can use it for your quill work. I was like, thank you. Because he was giving it to me, like, he like really wanted me to have it. So I didn't want to be like, yeah, I don't use it. And well, I still have it, but I tried and I could not get it small. And I felt like I was just wasting it. And I'm like, I don't want to waste it. So I put it away for I don't know what.
I remember taking some spruce boughs and spruce root out to a youth group in Scotchford. And I was like, you know, let's play name this tree, and had different types of branches from different evergreens. It's okay, what are the difference? What are you seeing? Are there needles flat? Do they go all the way around? Are they clustered? And that's how you start being able to tell the differences between the trees. So then we get to the part about the root, and my younger cousin sits down. I said, here, I said, you know, like, you guys can try it. It's probably going to be a little difficult, but here you go. And she sat down and just split the whole thing, and it was perfect and it was even. And I was just looking, I was like, wow, can you do it again? And she said, does it again. Here you go. You mean like this? I was like, wow, can I hire you? And I was just like so fascinated that, like, is that ancestral knowledge that's in her, that she had the knack for it. It was, didn't even blink an eye. It was perfectly done. Even I was in awe.
It's crazy how some people are like that, right? Like, they have it. It's mm-hmm. already there. And then you see it. I find I'm like that too. When I do sessions with like certain kids and stuff, I'm like, you're a natural. It's like, this is in you. It's mind blowing.
It is. we'll put some pictures up too of how small and how thin the spruce root needs to be in order to sew the quill work with it, because some of it is tiny. I use it occasionally. Don't do it often because it really, really takes a long time. So normally when I'm making my pieces, it's the quilling is what takes the most time. When I'm going to do the edging, if I'm just sewing sweetgrass on, that can be pretty quick. I can just get that done and then the piece is done. And I'm like, you know, sense of accomplishment. If I'm sewing it on with spruce root, it takes sometimes just as long as it did to do the quill work, because it's so painstaking. And, you know, again, it's just me having to get the knack of it and get better at it. It does take a long time. So I have to really be in the mood to use the spruce root in order to sew with it.
Yeah, that's not a mood for me.
All right.
I've tried.
Well, if you're willing to try the spruce root, you sure you won't try the tea?
No, I tried to use spruce root with my quill and not to eat it.
I know, I'm trying to sneak that in. Okay, what about the sweetgrass? Oh. If I make you tea with sweetgrass, because that's another thing you can make tea with.
Probably not.
My cats love it, if that's any inducement, whenever I'm soaking sweetgrass in water to like loosen it up so I can edge it. My cats have always got their noses in that water. They love it.
Cats also like to eat mice.
That's fair.
Just saying.
Which is a rodent, which is what porcupines are, which is maybe...
Oh my God, let's not get back to that. I'm not eating porcupines. No, I might try sweetgrass tea, maybe.
Yeah, it's nice, Kay. Like, I think it would be... Like, I could even put, like, in a little tea diffuser for you, so you wouldn't even really see it. Like, it's just a little... So now we're going to talk about Sanu. And Kay just had a little bit of a panic attack, because in our notes, I said Sanu, which is the tendons of a moose. And Kay...
I was like, holy choice words. Is that what we really use? Like, I was like, is that what I had? Like, I didn't know it. I can't even talk. I was like, I'm going to have to go and do something with that out there. Put it somewhere.
Okay. So sinew is what we use to sew when we don't have spruce root. Okay. So if you're having sweet grass and you're just going to sew it on, you can buy a spool of sinew and you could split it down into three and you can sew with it. So it's synthetic though. And the reason why Kay is having her panic attack is because there is a natural sinew that people use with leather working, with, you know, with sewing. And it is the tendons of an animal, right? So tendons and ligaments are what join either bone to muscle or bone to bone. That's what your body uses. It's strong, it's flexible, and you can break it down into smaller strips and you can sew with it. So Kay just had a bit of a panic attack when she thought that the spool of sinew she's been using all these years might be animal tendons, but it's not, Kay.
That freaked me right out when I read that. I'm like, oh, how do they sell that in stores?
But you know,
a warning label.
So I've actually had sinew, like actual proper moose sinew, from a friend of mine. And when it was first given to me, I just threw it. Yeah. But I had a little bit of a problem with my cat. And I apologize for talking so much about my cats, but they're always around when I'm doing this. And where it is a part of an animal, it was something that they were always trying to eat and would not leave alone. So it proved to be extremely problematic. The reason why my friend had to give it to me is because when a cousin of mine hunts moose and was getting moose meat for my family, and I had asked, like, can you put aside this, like, I want to sew with sinew. Can you put it aside for me? So when they were harvesting the moose, he put aside the tendons for me in a little pile. And wouldn't you know it, some crows came along and took off with it, you know, to eat. So we weren't able to get any of it from that hunt because of the birds.
Oh, those dreadful birds. Oh, that just blows my mind. I don't mean to have these mind-blowing moments through this whole podcast, but you know.
So when I say that the sinew that we use is synthetic, it is kind of almost like a plasticky fiber. The synthetic sinew is the only manufactured portion of the quill work that we use. That's the only thing that's not natural.
Oh, I should have clued in. I say that all the time. The only thing that's synthetic on my quill work is the sinew. I knew that. I think it might have been just seeing it clouded that on my end.
You know what I forgot though to talk about, Kay, was the spruce root before we moved on, is that sometimes I use the spruce root to sew, but I also use the spruce root to fill the gap and sew on to the bark.
I thought you were going to say you're eating another part of it.
No, I'm not eating. So what I will do, we'll take a strip of spruce root and then soak it so that it's pliable, bend it into a circle or, you know, square, depending on which such shape my quill work is, and then just sew it on and then do it that way as the edge. So not just the material to sew with, but also the edge that goes along the bark.
Oh, that's what I thought we were talking about all along. Edging it.
Well, that's what I'm saying. And then we kind of started talking about what we were sewing with and how we were sewing with the spruce root to split it. But we didn't talk about actually using the spruce root as the gap filler with the bark, yeah, in between the bark and the quill work.
That's what I was talking about, though.
Oh.
Different, like in my head, that's what I, where the sweetgrass goes around the quill work. That's where the spruce root goes.
Yeah. One thing I've never done with it actually is dye it. And I know that from some of the museum pieces, they used to dye the spruce root different colors. And then when they were wrapping with it or sewing with it or whatever, it would add to the design of the piece as a whole, as opposed to just keeping it the natural brown color. So I'm thinking,
dying quilts this afternoon. Maybe I should try that.
Well, and you're saying that your uncle gave it to you and you haven't used it yet. That might be something something kind of fun to do with it.
Oh, I might do that this afternoon.
So it'll be interesting to see how the colors differ, because I mean, where it's more of a wood, it'll be probably darker, I'm guessing, but it'll be really cool to see.
I'll send you pictures when I'm done.
Okay, that would be cool.
Because everybody, since I've been complaining since the first episode, I got black dye. So I'm going to have some black quills.
Well, and that would make a really good color to dye the spruce root too, because it's dark anyway, right? So you won't have to worry. Because I can't imagine like a yellow would dye or anything like that. You'd have to be reds and blues and stuff like that.
Well, this afternoon I'm doing a red.
Oh, perfect.
Because I already did a black the other day. So yeah, I'll see how that works. I wonder, like, I wouldn't have to split it though, right? Like, would the dye seep right into the whole, like...
Well, you can take a look at it and see it, because it's the first time that we've dyed them.
Yeah.
Because I imagine it wouldn't soak probably all the way through, depending on how thick the root is. Yeah, because some of the roots are really thick, right? Like when you have them, what I was told as a rule of thumb is that it should be the size of your thumb. Because when you take the bark off it, it makes it, you know, that takes off some of the thickness of it. And then when you split it, take the core out, then you're left with pieces that are manageable and workable. Hmm. And the reason why I know that they used to dye the spruce root when they were wrapping it is because, again, at the museum pieces, when you take the lids off and look on the inside of the boxes, you can see the colors because they don't fade as much as the outside of the boxes do. And so that's how you can tell which colors were being used.
Nice.
And I know that people have a lot of questions about our dyeing. Those are some of the ones that have been coming in that people want to know about the old dyeing techniques that our ancestors wouldn't have used before contact. And then even some of the more modern ones and hearing Kay talk a little bit about using her black and red. But I wanted to let you know that we will be doing a full episode on dyeing. Then we'll talk about all of the ins and outs of it and how it gets done. Can I ask you this? Have you ever finished like a big piece of quill work and then start to sew and split the bark while you're sewing the edge on?
Yep.
Did you cry?
I don't think I want to talk about that.
Talk about what you did.
It's really upsetting. When I finish a big piece, it's like my masterpiece. Like I'm so invested in it because of the time it takes to do it and just the energy that you put into it, like on a spiritual level. It's like, oh, it's devastating when that happens.
Exactly. Because when we're putting our designs onto the bark, I mentioned before that you have to be careful not to poke a lot of holes along the grain. Otherwise, it'll, you know, compromise the strength. But when you're sewing an edge on, especially if it's square, you really run the risk of doing that because you have all of the little holes all in a line. And that's what you're sewing it in. So using an awl will definitely help with that because you want to make sure that you're piercing through the bark as opposed to, you know, punching it. Because if your awl gets dull, that's actually what ends up happening. And also make sure that your spacing is slightly wide enough to make sure that you are minimizing the risk of it just splitting all the way around the edge.
It's like a whole little science in itself on how to do this.
And sometimes
I've done it through trial and error too, right? So then it's like, those errors.
And it's almost like creating a seam allowance, right? To know how far out from the quill work you have to cut the bark so that you don't have too much or too little. And then once you have it, you don't want to sew too close to the quills. And we used barbed needles in order to do it. So when you're pushing your needle up through, you have to stay away from the quills. Otherwise you will cut them and pierce them. When you're quilling, if you are piercing a quill, it makes this little pop sound, like this little pop. I hate that noise because I know if I'm sewing the edge on and I hear that, I'm like, great, now I'm going to have to go back and take that quill out, replace it. Hopefully I haven't split it. You know, hopefully it's not going to just destroy the whole piece. And I thought I was done. And it's just maddening sometimes when you get to that point, if you hear that little noise and realize that you've just split either the wood or the quill.
Yep, it really is.
Oh, we didn't really talk about the quills, what we do with the quills.
Oh, right. Yeah, the thing that I don't mind doing.
When I first looked at pieces, when they were edged with quills, they're bigger quills that are kind of end to end all the way around. And at first, what I was doing was cutting off the follicle end and trying to force the barb end into it to kind of make a chain, right? Like all connected together and then sew that around. But of course, the barbed end is black and it's bigger on that end than it is on the follicle end. So I was always splitting the quills and, you know, it was just horrible. And I don't know why I was doing it that way, because of course it makes a lot more sense to cut off the barbed end and put the follicle end into that because it's wider. The follicle end is smaller. It's still pointy, so it will stick and you can still make your connected chain of quills to sew around the edge. And I did that for far, far too long before I realized I was doing it backwards. words. See,
this is why I'm glad I had you to teach me, because you already went through all that. So then when it was time for me to learn, it was like, this is the easiest way to do it. This is how you can do it. I'm just so thankful for that, because I would have probably did the exact same thing.
See, and that's why to this day, when I'm sewing with the quills, I'm just like, I'm doing it the easy way. Look how easy this is. And I still kind of like doing it, because it was so painstaking for so long that I'm still just really quite happy when it happens easier. I use the bigger quills that I can't quill with, like the really big ones. We talked about that. The quills get too large and they're not really used. So when I have my dye batches, when I have the big quills that match the colors, that's what I'll use for edging. So it uses them up. You're not wasting the quills or the effort that it took to get them and to dye them. I also find that it can really help pop out the colors in the designs when you're using colored quills around the edge. So sometimes I use like a line of one quill or two quills, you know, sometimes they're the same color, sometimes they're opposite colors, whatever the design's using. But I really find that sometimes it'll really, really set off the design in a way that the spruce root and the sweetgrass just don't.
You know, after this episode, I think I might need to venture out a little more in my edging.
Well, try it. Because what do you do with your quills that are too big to quill with? Like, what do you do with them now?
Most of them, I give them to my a neighbor kid. She does quill work too. So I give them to her. She makes earrings out of them and stuff like that. And they're pretty, they're real cute. I like them. Sometimes I give them to her. Sometimes I just like hoard them.
And for what? Right? Like,
right?
Because it gets frustrating sometimes. You'll have a container of quills and you're like, oh, I really love that color. And then you open the lid and look at them and you're like, and none of them in this container I can use anymore because I've picked out all of the ones that are quillable.
Yeah. They're either like super small or like big old jumbo ones.
Finished a piece this week that I actually used two different colors on the edging. I used a white and kind of a turquoise. And I really liked how that turned out.
I thought that was beautiful.
Yeah, it turned out well.
But I see a lot of pieces that I think are super beautiful with like all the colors in it or the edging, but I just can't seem to be that adventurous.
Which is fine, because I mean, you have your own style, right?
Yeah.
It's the one that I was doing, I was sewing the quills on in a circle. And that was a little bit more complicated because of course quills are straight. So it's really quick and easy to do if you're just doing a square or a rectangle, yeah, you know, to edge, because then you just have to bend the quill in the corner. But when you're using a circle, it's a little bit more painstaking to make sure that it doesn't actually end up looking kind of like a hexagon or something when you're done with it, you know, to make sure that the edge is smooth. And a lot of that just comes down with the tension on the sinew, which again is where you risk splitting the bark when you put the holes in. So yeah, it can be a little bit more painstaking than the sweetgrass, because the sweetgrass just doesn't push back, if you will. Like, it's very pliable. You can bend it. You don't have to worry about it. And the spruce root is actually even harder than the quills, because if it dries out, then it gets really hard and brittle, and then you don't want to risk breaking it. That's another one that I find really difficult to do in a circle, because it's just trying to bend the wood around at an angle that it wouldn't naturally do. So that gets a little bit more complex too.
Yeah, and then, that makes sense.
And then sewing the edges together so one edge doesn't pop out of your stitching. Have you ever used thread?
I've always used sinew. Like when we were done, you gave me a good amount. Yeah. And then shortly after that, one of my older friends were here visiting and she was like, do you need anything? Because she was coming from Charlottetown. She brought me back a nice big spool. And then when I was almost done with that one, someone who I work with was like, here's another one. And then I've never run out. Yeah. So I've never had to like resort to thread. Have you tried colored sinew?
No, I kind of like, because I never know what my design's going to look like, right? So when it comes to the sinew, I like to have it a little bit more natural or neutral. That way, when I'm sewing with it, it's just a neutral color and I don't have to worry about if it clashes or where you buy the spools. Because I mean, I've had my spool of sinew for years. I would worry that if I had a color of it, then I'd be like, what am I going to do with that much? You know, for the pieces that the color it wouldn't work with. So I tend just to go neutral.
Yeah, a spool lasts quite a while.
It's kind of funny, like when you want it to accent something and when you just want it to fade into the background with it, right? So do you like edging, Kay? Like, do you think like, oh, that's the end of the piece. This is just the last stage and then I'll be done. Or do you like, oh, I'm done my quilling. Now I have to edge.
No, I like to edge. When I do my Christmas decorations that I sell, I have my four designs that I do. So I'll do like 10 of every one. When I'm done doing that, I binder clip them all together after I poke all the holes, and then I sweetgrass them all. So I sweetgrass like 60 pieces all at the same time after quilling them all. And I don't mind doing that.
I find that I don't mind doing it as long as my needle's sharp. If you pierce through and then you kind of jiggle a little bit when you're pulling the needle through with the sinew on it, it really can inflame my carpal tunnel because it's really hard on my wrists and my fingers when I'm doing it. So I use an awl to pre-punch the holes. But again, you have to do it like right before you start sewing. Otherwise, it'll start closing up. And we use Glover's needles, leather Glover needles that have got 3 barbs on them. And they're used in leather work. Anytime you're using something to cut wood, it dulls really quickly. So I always just kind of have, whenever I'm buying them, I buy a lot because I find that I've actually probably stuck my fingers more using the barbed needles than I ever have with quills. I have to make sure that my tetanus is up to date because I keep getting all these little holes and pricks on that from these metal needles. So I think that's probably it for the edging, Kay.
Yeah, I think so too.
All right. So what are you working on now?
I'm going to be working on so much now that I got my black quills. So excited. They're drying in my back room right now. But that took a long time to dye, like the black color.
I think we're going to have to do the dyeing one next, maybe, you think? Yeah. So we can explain the trials and tribulations of dyeing to people.
Quick story, though. When I was doing, this is dyeing, should be on the next one. But when I was dyeing my black the other day, I do it outside. And didn't it start downpouring rain? So then it was getting into the pot that I had out there. And all this black dye was flying everywhere, all over the place, all over the side of my house. I was like, what am I going to do? And then I'm like, how do I grab it? Like the pot to bring it in because it's on a little hot plate. I'm looking at it and this dye is flying everywhere, all over the place, all over my arms and everything. And I'm like, just grab it. Just like talking to myself, like amping myself up, like just grab it. Like, anyway, I got it off the side of my house.
That's good.
But I got my black quills. So that's what I'm working on right now. And I have like 3 or 4 designs that I've already done up. So once my quills dry and then I go through them to make sure none of them are bent or cracked or whatever, then I'll be starting my quill pieces.
Cool. I actually finished up a piece and I'm going to post some pictures on it once the person gets it, because it does have that edging with the 2 different colors so people could take a look at it. And then this week I'm going to be working on a piece for a wedding, and I'm really excited about the design because I'm basically going to have 2 pieces with their own separate vibrant designs on them. But when you put them side by side, it's going to make a complete star in the middle. So I'm a little excited about that because I thought that that was a good idea for a wedding gift. All right. So moving on to the listener question. This question comes from Nancy, actually out in Saskatchewan. And she wants to know, how do you decide on your designs, or is it different every time?
When I do my designs, I see it. So then I just put it to graph paper and my base is a star and I just go from there. I try to make sure that they're all different, but when I just need to quill, then I repeat it like a small design.
I think your Christmas tree ornaments are the ones that you make the most of, right? Because you'll come up with your design.
Yeah. So I think I have like 5 different ones, 4 or 5 different Christmas designs. And yeah, those are my repetitive ones. And sometimes I'll be doing those in the middle of summer. Just because I need a quill, but I just don't have the inspiration right in that moment to make something really big. And then that kind of gets my juices flowing.
I usually do new inspired pieces. I have a couple that I actually designed out years ago that I haven't made yet. I have one that's a petroglyph moose that I've been trying to do for the past 5 years. And the poor thing hasn't gotten made yet, because I find that whenever I sit down to do quilling, I'll start getting all these different ideas, all these different inspirations and stuff. And so whatever's kind of fresh my mind is what I like to make. It's also one of the reasons why I sometimes struggle with commissioned pieces, because I like to be able to make whatever I think of, right? And sometimes that doesn't always match what the person tried to order. And I work really, really hard to not duplicate design. Or even if they're extremely similar, there will be noticeable differences in them, because I don't want people buying a piece of quill work that's handmade, that's unique, and then having, you know, seeing one that's the same. And I think that that's part of the reason as well, why we start to collaborate with the Quill Sisters, to make sure that we weren't copying designs, so that people do have the security of knowing that if they're buying a piece from us, that it, especially the big ones, that they will be unique. Some of the smaller pieces, like the Christmas tree ornaments and some of the smaller stars and single stars, we do those over and over and over again. When it comes to the inspirations, those are the ones that I get and make as they come to me. All right. So where can people reach us, Kay?
You can reach me on Facebook at Kay's Creations and on Instagram at KayStark9001.
And I can be reached at Mi'kmaq Quill Art by Cheryl Simon on Facebook. And I also want to announce that we've launched actually a Facebook page called Ebiguit Quilt Sisters, and that will have all of the links to the podcasts for the downloads. And we also post the pictures of the quilt pieces and what we're talking about during the podcast on that page as well. And there is an email address. So if you have any questions or just would like to get a hold of us, it's ebiguitquiltsisters@gmail.com.
Please subscribe to Ebiguit Quilt Sisters. And if you like us, give us a 5-star review.
The Milk Desk.
The Milk Desk.